Welcome back to the 20 Under 20s podcast, where we interview the teenagers of Generation Z who are making a huge impact in business.
I think free work at a young age is an amazing thing because you can actually go to the people that you want to learn from most or go to the companies you want to learn from most. And if you are showcasing that you can provide value, articulating that you're interested in providing that sort of value for free and you've done your homework, then it's going to be hard for people to say no to that.
Hey guys, I'm super excited to have Jared Kleinert on the show today. Jared is an entrepreneur, TED and keynote speaker, and award-winning author. He has become a sought-after millennial thought leader and has been referred to as the most connected millennial by USA Today. Jared's first book, 2 Billion Under 20, was released in July 2015 and voted the number one entrepreneurship and small business book for the year by the Axiom Business Book Awards. His new book, 3 Billion Under 30, just came out and is on sale right now. It features stories from the world's smartest and most talented people in their 20s and early 30s. Jared has additionally been named a champion for humanity by the United Nations and was a delegate to President Obama's Global Entrepreneurship Summit in Malaysia in 2013. Thanks so much for joining me, Jared.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So just to talk about some of the stuff, your background, and a little bit about what led you to entrepreneurship. So a little bit about your education, and then have you always been interested in entrepreneurship, or was it something that developed over time?
So very fortunately, I grew up in an entrepreneurial family. And so I was surrounded, since I can remember, with about four or five family businesses that are still running today, from a catering business in South Florida that's been around for, I don't even know, like 15 years. And I started working, you know, with my grandma and my dad in that business at 11, catering random parties, barbecues and bounce house birthdays and all that random stuff, to construction. You know, my family on the other side has a very large but not very well-known construction business that has been started 40 years ago in New York City. So there's a bunch of entrepreneurs in my family. My parents had two restaurants when I was a baby, but they both failed ultimately. And so as I was growing up, my parents had pretty regular 9-to-5 jobs. And that was also good because I wasn't entitled to anything financially from my family. And so I had this entrepreneurial inspiration. You know, I had the wherewithal to know that that was a career path, but I also was entitled to none of the financial gains of other family members. And so that didn't give me any entitlements, and it really sparked part of the fire in me to want to replicate that. And at the same time, you know, sort of tackle some of the things that we look for as we're growing up, like having great personal relationships while you're becoming financially successful, having great health while you're becoming financially successful, having a great lifestyle. I think a lot of our generation and your generation feels like we don't need to sacrifice those sort of things anymore. And I think that's partly true. I don't know if you can have everything all at once, but I don't think we need to sacrifice as much as we used to. And so, you know, very fortunate to grow up in that sort of environment. I got started at 13 doing social entrepreneurial things, which I don't normally share, but I had organized a shoe drive at my middle school to provide kids in the Miami-Dade area with gently used shoes, because I grew up in South Florida. And so we collected about 150 pairs of shoes over a couple months and donated that to kids in need. And then at 15, I tried to create my first startup, which failed miserably, but learned a lot from it. And that's when I really began investing a lot of time and energy into brainwashing myself about entrepreneurship. I didn't necessarily listen to podcasts back then. Maybe that was like 17 or 18. I started listening to podcasts, but I would read, you know, Forbes and Entrepreneur and books and just anything I can get my hands on, and just started driving to entrepreneurial events at 16 when I got my license. And, you know, the rest is history.
Yeah. And just hitting on two things from that. How influential would you say being able to work inside a family business and getting that perspective of what an entrepreneurial lifestyle is like had an influence on you today?
I think it's huge. And even at a, you know, if you want to zoom out of that, I think any sort of experience at a young age that you can get where you are watching a real life business, or if you don't want to go into a business, a real life practitioner do his or her thing is really valuable. So what I mean by that is if you want to become a doctor, I don't think the first step should be going to school for 8 or 10 years. I think the first step should be shadowing around a doctor who's in the position that you want to ultimately be in. Same with the legal field, same with entrepreneurship. And so my biggest learning moments when I was in my teens was from working for pretty successful VC-backed startups. So from 16 to 18, I worked for two companies. I spent 3 months at a company that was venture-backed and ended up spinning a product out of their first company and raising $20 million for this second company right as I was leaving a three-month internship. And then I spent another 2 years total with a VC-backed startup called 15-5. And by far and away, like most of my network goes back to those learning experiences. I still keep in touch with both of my old bosses. I consider them mentors. And just having that exposure, which is something I worked for because no one in my family had those connections. And I never wanted family connections or family help in the first place. But those exposures really changed my life and changed how I started, you know, viewing my educational path, my career path, et cetera.
Yeah, that must have been amazing to have those opportunities. And one of the things that I know a lot of high schoolers and even people who are just interested in business that are pre-college or during college is they're interested in internships, like you just said. But a lot of them don't know how to go about getting involved with that. So I think I'd remembered you telling me you had just cold emailed all of them, right? Until you finally started to get some responses.
So you're almost there. And that's a better start than most people. You know, most people won't take initiative to make a cold reach out to someone they admire or someone they want to have an internship with. And so if you're doing that, you're already ahead of the competition. I went a little bit further in terms of being conscious about that reach out. And the only reason I reached out to the CEO of 15-5 is because I read an article about him and understood at some level that that's who I wanted to emulate more so than other entrepreneurs. And there were specific reasons why I wanted to emulate that person. And so I would really think hard about the types of skill sets, the types of relationships that you want to be exposed to if you're going to make a cold email and look for an internship. Because the way I would suggest doing it is not talk about money at the beginning, you know, just talk about the value you can provide to the other person. I think free work at a young age is an amazing thing because you can actually go to the people that you want to learn from most or go to the companies you want to learn from most. And if you are showcasing that you can provide value and articulating that you're interested in providing that sort of value for free and you've done your homework, then it's going to be hard for people to say no to that. And you put yourself in a much better position than sort of cold emailing everyone and looking for a job or cold emailing everyone just for advice. You know, the more specific you can get with your request or with your outreach, the better results you'll probably have. So I reached out because I wanted to emulate a person's skills and I wanted to emulate that person's network. You know, even if I didn't get the same exact relationships, I wanted to know how to build relationships like the CEO of 15-5. And so I would think about what skills you want to learn and what experiences you want to have, and then go find the companies and the opportunities that would allow you to get that exposure.
Yeah. And I know one of your skills and something that you are sort of a leader of is getting connected and becoming networked with people. So would you say that's sort of the same thing, knowing exactly what you want to learn from them and how you could be of value to them too and offering something to them first and then seeing if you can connect in the long run?
Yeah, that's the way to meet everyone is if you can, you know, be a good person, which shouldn't have to be mentioned, but unfortunately, there's a lot of not very good people out there.
Yeah.
Or not very nice people. So just like be a good person, have high integrity. Once you got that step zero taken care of, then go and provide value to people up front without expectation of return. And if you can do those things, you can meet a lot of people.
Yeah, and because most people will definitely take any help they can get, especially if it's somebody that's interested in the topic.
Yeah.
And going back to when you were 15, you started your first startup. I know a lot of people sort of see failure as like some terrible thing, especially when, but I feel like using it when you're young is great because all you could do is just learn from it. And it's not like you still have a house to live in, you still have a family that loves you. So what was that experience like and what did you learn from it?
I certainly don't advocate trying to fail.
Yeah.
But I think when you're young, you can make bigger risks or you can take bigger risks. And so if that means failing, then that is not the worst downside in the world. And a lot of entrepreneurs are very risk adverse. So they think about what is the potential downside in this deal or in this opportunity. And so if you're, you know, creating a company and you're not taking on fundraising, you're sort of just trying to figure out if an idea will work or not. The downside is it doesn't work and you've spent, you know, a few months or half a year or a year while you're, you know, probably living with your parents and going to school as per usual. And maybe you gave up a few hours of doing video games or some time hanging out with friends. You know, you gave up some opportunity costs, but that's not a bad downside, especially when the upside could be financial freedom at a very young age or financial independence when you're 18. And so then your decision of whether or not to go to college or whether or not to take a gap year, you know, becomes an easier decision to make, or you just have more leverage there. And that's a very important thing to consider as you, you know, begin building a career. You'll already be years ahead of people from learnings and or from net worth and sort of assets you've built. So there's a lot of upside when you're young and there's very little downside in my opinion.
Yeah. And how was that decision-making process for you? Once you hit senior year in high school and people were talking about college, where was your head at, or you had already made a decision?
So my thought process, which a lot of people don't use, and I can sort of see the roadblock as to why, is I took one gap year from school. I didn't commit anywhere, in large part because I didn't get accepted to any schools. And the reason I didn't get accepted into any schools is because I don't believe in the safety school idea. I'm sure you know about this, but a lot of families will talk about applying to pretty hard to get into schools, like an Ivy League school, or you know, maybe one or two notches below an Ivy League school. And then typically in affluent communities or great high schools, or you know, like when you're in a middle class area, a lot of people will talk about safety schools as well, because for some reason, you know, we feel entitled to send our kids to college, and we'd sort of be mortified if they didn't go to a school. And so you apply to like safety schools that you think you'll get into or know you'll get into, and you apply to these ambitious schools that it's kind of 50-50 or maybe 90%, 10% that you'll get in. And to me, it just didn't make sense to apply to safety schools because I didn't find that I would get an ROI from being there. In terms of the name recognition of the school, in terms of the network I would get, you know, the educational product. I thought it was either apply and get into very prestigious schools or perhaps take a gap year and reapply. And so with that logic, I only applied to the top schools. I didn't get in and took a gap year. And I probably would have taken a gap year even if I got into a prestigious school. Can't talk today. But
so you would have taken the gap year and then like deferred it for a year and then went.
Yeah, well, I'll finish walking you through it. But I ended up taking a gap year, and I think the great thing about a gap year is you're not forced into a decision. And you're sort of making a decision that gives you more options down the road. Because you can use that gap year to continue tinkering with whatever career path you want to go down. You can use that gap year to build some life experiences, perhaps travel, perhaps dating someone, perhaps learning some new skills, doing something to improve yourself, whether it's career oriented or not. Maybe it's just lifestyle oriented. And then when you are faced with that decision again, a year down the line, you know, and have taken some time to reapply for schools, or maybe you accepted a school but took a gap year, you'll go into that decision more mature than you were beforehand, because you've had an additional year to build skills, to understand what passions you may have, and can therefore make a new choice. And so my choice after taking 1 year of a gap year and reapplying to schools, which I had actually gotten into NYU, which is a pretty good school, as I took a second gap year, and this was my first official gap year from NYU. So I kind of knew what I was doing by then, and I had a good sense I wasn't going to go to school, but I still want to give myself the option. And then by the end of doing 2 gap years, my career was already, you know, going to a point where I felt comfortable just not going to school altogether. And I've never walked into a college classroom as a college student. I mean, I've done college classes in high school, but, you know, to this day, don't have a degree, never started. Can't even say I'm a college dropout. But I did high school.
Yeah.
It was a very deliberate process. It wasn't, you know, a rash decision. It was a multi-year decision. And I gave myself permission to make that decision.
Yeah, I know that must be a difficult decision, especially when the status quo, I guess, right now in a lot of families, like, you're going to go to college, you're going to get your degree, and this is what you're going to go for after. But I'm sure that's a great idea, I think, leaving all your options open and then having the opportunity to go, but also getting an extra year to get older and think about what you want to do.
Yeah, I mean, let's explore that logic a little bit. You know, so I think most people would be happy with the status quo, right? Like, I know we're entrepreneurial, you know, the people listening here, me and you, but I think most people would be happy with a pretty safe and standard path, especially in a world that's increasingly unpredictable. And that's cool. And I think taking a gap year will allow you to be even more conservative with your decision of how you spend your time in your educational years and where you spend the money, you know, what sort of career path you want to go down. At the end of the day, when you're 30, you're not going to look back and feel like you lost a year if you took a gap year. I think if anything, you will have accelerated your life faster than someone who went straight from high school to college.
Yeah, because
just because you have time to think logically, or, you know, more rationally, more maturely about those important decisions.
Absolutely. And clearly it seems like to you it has worked out for you, and it didn't make any impact on your life, it seems.
Yeah, and my logic is, like, I'm scared of the status quo. Like, one of my biggest fears is normalcy, or getting stuck in what I call a vicious cycle of normalcy, because I grew up seeing my parents, you know, for various reasons, you know, sort of not being able to get out of a 9-to-5 world and never being able to advance themselves to the level they wanted to, or just in general. And my mom is very ambitious. She'd make a great entrepreneur, I feel like. But up until maybe 2 years ago, when my brother left home for school, and even now, to some extent, she feels trapped by the pressures of having raised 2 kids pretty much by herself, because I come from a divorced family. And there's just a lot of pressures. It's really hard for a pretty much single mom raising 2 kids to quit her job and go build a company. And yeah. So that's why it's so important that if you want to take those big, bold risks, you do it as early and, you know, as possible, before all those, you know, traps of normalcy come into your life. And, you know, to me, like, I still fear that to this day. And I knew that I would put myself in a position to be trapped by normalcy if I went the same path that everyone else did. And yeah. So by not going to school, you know, I by default am different.
Yeah.
And so that will either turn into something that's really positive for me, or, you know, you could say the other end of that spectrum is it's very, very negative. But I think by not going to school, I've had to work for my network, whereas most people have a geographic network given to them, or they're put into a box of people that they, you know, need to learn to deal with. And sort of every other, you know, thing, like I was financially independent since 18, and that was part of making my decision to take a gap year. So I had to figure out how to put money in my bank account and pay my bills, especially moving to the most expensive city in the world, or one of, in New York City, when I was 18. And so there's a lot of different real life decisions that I had to learn how to make. And I think as difficult as some of the last few years have been at times, they've also been extremely rewarding when I stop and think about it, to know that I've been able to build all that up without the transitional period of college, which a lot of people think is fun and feel like it's a great place to be safe. But if you don't do it carefully, you might walk out with 80 or 100K in student debts because a lot of families can't afford that going in. And so it's a real serious trap. And I don't preach going to school, not going to school. I just preach being conscious about your decision.
Yeah. And what you're saying about doing it before normalcy ties in about going out and trying. I was talking to Mike Klum, who I had also interviewed, and he was saying, do it before, like you had said, do it before you have kids, do it before anything, do it to the point where if you wanted to, you could pick up and leave and go wherever you needed to. Not because once you have kids and or you have a family that relies on you, everything changes. Like you said, with your mom, like it becomes much more stressful to quit a job because now it's not just you on the line. It's your entire family.
Yeah.
And sorry, what were you going to say?
No, I mean, obviously I haven't experienced that, and doesn't mean it's impossible if, you know, if there's a parent listening to this or, you know, someone with kids listening to make changes then. But yeah, so there's certainly less holding you back.
Yeah. And talking about just some of the stuff you've done since you made that decision in the last couple of years, you've released two books, 2 billion under 20, 3 billion under 30. And you've done some TED Talks. So can you just talk about the experience of having the opportunity to do all of those things and some of your experiences writing the books and the publishing process and then trying to market it too?
Yeah, there's a lot to uncover there.
Yeah, I sort of threw everything on you there.
So when I was 17, I was able to go to a conference hosted by Peter Thiel's foundation, the Thiel Foundation. And it was the first time in my life I was surrounded by other like-minded young entrepreneurs, because about 5 years ago, there weren't any real online communities for young entrepreneurs. There weren't any offline communities for young entrepreneurs. And they were sort of the first group that brought together, you know, everyone and anyone who was young doing crazy, wacky stuff. And for one reason or another, I got invited to that event. It completely blew my mind. And I also saw some sort of a need in the months following to contribute to sharing some of the stories of the people in the room and getting more and more young people to act on their passions in life and unite in solving big pressing problems that our society faces. And so there was a keynote at that event that talked about how there's 20 people selected for this Thiel Fellowship program, which you can Google Thiel Fellowship and learn more about if you're curious. I won't spend time talking about it here. The keynote speaker also then went on to say that there was about 200 people in the room that day, and yet there's about 2 billion people in the world at or under 20 years old. So he left us with that logic and then sort of challenged us to spread the virus and get more young people to do amazing things with their lives. And so that idea stuck in my head for a few months. And one day I was in the shower and realized that, you know, a book might be a good way to spread those stories. And, you know, for, you know, with that idea, I went to the Facebook group that the summit had set up, typed in what I thought would be this book idea. And within half an hour, there was 50 likes on the thread, 60 comments, 2-3 people wanted to be co-authors, three or four people had sent in stories, and it just took off from there. So that ended up becoming $2 billion under 20. It went from sharing the stories of the people in that community to sort of a personal and professional mission to identify and connect just top performing millennials across all different walks of life and all over the world. And so that book shared stories from 75 people who before 20 had gone on to do ridiculous things like build nuclear reactors in their garage or start global nonprofit movements that saved lives or started seven-figure businesses or made the Olympics. And so there was just a really crazy group of people that contributed. And with $3 billion under 30, was able to kind of step it up another level, went to top performers in their 20s and early 30s, and was able to get people like the founder of WordPress to be involved, and you know, people who started major media companies like Leak Daily and Levo and Upload VR, which is one of the largest hubs of information in the virtual reality space, and major social media influencers like a Jake Paul or a Shonduras. And, you know, just continually humbled by the people who have bought into this project, whether it was in a sharing a tweet to promote the book or giving me 20 or 30 minutes so we can interview them and transcribe their story for the book, or spending hours writing their story to be included in the book or in one of the two books. And so this has been a passion project of mine. I have turned it into part of how I make money and part of how I pay my bills. But I do feel that there's a lot of long-term potential in terms of building that community and building an audience around it, building a brand. So that's what I've spent a lot of time doing in the last 3-4 years and will continue to do. And it's also another thing where I made a decision that it gave me more optionality. So you can see a trend in how I think, because you know, I do this book, I build an amazing network. And that network gives me optionality to go into any sort of industry I want to in the future, provided I continue giving value to these people and having high integrity and being their cheerleader. So regardless of whether I'm in this startup world, like when I originally got started in my career, I've taken this like speaker, author, consultant turn in the last 3 or 4 years, you know, I'll have optionality regardless of where I go. And that's a very intentional thing.
Yeah, because now you can go anywhere from social media to VR to any space you want, and you'll have a network in those industries, which is amazing.
Yeah, and then in my day-to-day work, it's also one of the best ways to get a competitive edge, is because I have influences from such a wide variety of people and industries, and my information sources are just so much better than most people's and so much more, you know, diverse. So I can take best practices in one industry, apply it to another, and see amazing results for me or for my clients in a consulting business that I run. And there's just a lot of value in that.
Yeah. And I'm sure the last few months has been insane with your book release. So could you just talk a little bit about the experience of launching a book and what it's been like? I know you've been doing some book tours and stuff like that, and just the experience of that.
Yeah. So to be honest, I don't think that a lot of what our peers are doing is very valuable to them long term. And so when people launch books or launch a big project, you know, it is a good time to go get press, but I think it should be really restricted to a few weeks where you're getting press, because unless you're getting involved with the right journalists or the right bloggers and doing it in a very conscious way, press and things that look nice on paper or look nice in a bio won't actually move your business forward. And so with the book launch, it was a great time to go get additional press. And you know, I had a video I did with Leak Daily about Donald Trump and his use of Twitter that got like over 160,000 views. I was able to do an event with NPR. I've spoken at Facebook. You know, got featured in Forbes, LinkedIn, Inc., whatever. But when you look at the numbers, you know, that doesn't really drive sales as much as you think. And so, you know, it also is a nice like ego boost, but what time did I give up in, you know, trying to get all those opportunities that I could have otherwise spent in building sustainable marketing channels or sustainable business development channels, or, you know, continuing to invest in my network, or, you know, continue investing in maybe another product or, you know, a service. So there's a lot you give up with a launch that just most people don't think about. And it's great for social proof, which is why you should do it. But you should keep it in its box and then go on to the next thing of importance. And so like today, my day to day, I don't really spend a lot of time on podcasts, and I don't spend a lot of time seeking press because I have all the logos that people want. You know, I've been featured in almost every major media outlet, unless, you know, a super qualified journalist came along and had a big following and was a staff writer at a huge publication where I just knew whatever they wrote was going to blow up, or, you know, someone with a blog that was very tied into my industry wanted to do something with me. You know, those would be opportunities that I would probably push a business result. So launch was good. I think what happens after a launch is more interesting and more important, because a lot of people will launch something and then it just goes away. And if you're working on things that are really important, you want to have some longevity there. And so I actually think, you know, what happens in the next 3 to 6 months for 3 billion under 30 will be far more interesting and difficult than launching the book, which I did in January.
Yeah, I'm sure that because what you're saying about press, I hadn't really thought about it that way. But I, like you said, I guess it's more just for personal branding. And I guess you could use it on like you said, for an ego or an as seen on kind of thing, like as featured in Forbes or whatever. But it doesn't really drive.
It shows social proof and credibility to a point. But after people get past that, they're going to look for your real results. And they're going to understand and speak into you what sort of value you have to provide. And so you can't live on social proof or credibility. Like, that'll get you in the door, or that'll pique some interest from others. But that's why I say, like, check that box off as quickly as possible and then go to the next thing.
And would you say that next thing is marketing, sales? What would you say that next step after getting, opening the door and getting initial publicity is?
It's different for everything and everyone. And so, you know, If we're going to talk about like a book launch or a product launch more generically, I think using a launch to drive initial sales so you can reinvest that capital is a great thing. And I also think it should be used for social proof and should be turned into an event. But as soon as you get past that, you know, the funds that you have from that initial cash infusion should be reinvested into some marketing and business development experiments. What I mean by experiments is you want to build marketing and business development channels that long-term will continuously drive business for you. And so before you know if that's possible, you have to test one or two marketing channels at a time in a very, you know, cheap way and in a very fast way. And if you do that, you protect your downside of spending all the money that you just made on the launch. And you potentially have upside. You know, if something works, then you can systemize it. You can figure out why it worked and continue doing more of that. So that's what I would do next is, you know, after you get past the launch, figure out how you can experiment in some marketing channels. For every type of business, it's going to be different, but I'll give you my examples. So for the book, you know, I'm about to start experimenting with content marketing. And using a lot of the content from the book to make blog posts and social media posts and videos and all sorts of stuff like that that links back to the book. And I'm also going to be experimenting with paid traffic and buying Facebook ads and all that fun stuff. And so if that works, then I'll keep doing it. If it doesn't work, I'll stop doing it. But some people might try outbound sales where they're just like cold emailing and cold calling 100 people a week. Some people might try and build a PR strategy, but they'll have to be conscious about what the real ROI is on that activity and on that experiment and see how they can systemize it and scale it over time. And there's like 36 other different marketing or business development channels you can test. But, you know, again, I would keep it conscious, keep it scientific, and grow that way. Because launches are sexy, but you know, real businesses or real results are on the evergreen, the long term, the continued effort.
Yeah, and I know even just for like you had said, for book launch, the long term effect. I know even for podcasting, like you had said, the launch is sexy, but the long term is the hard part. Like, I think the average podcast lasts 7 episodes and then people quit. Like, it's the fact that it's all hyped up about the launch, but then like that's when it gets difficult. Like you said, right after those first couple episodes are out, and then you got to keep pushing to expand it and scale it.
Yeah. And like Tim Ferriss had the classic example where he committed to doing 8 videos or eight podcasts or 10 podcasts as an experiment. And then once he saw that the experiment was working, he continued doing it over and over and over and over again.
Yeah. And he realized
Tim Ferriss, but I think a similar process is one to consider. You know, hey, I want to grow my business or grow my brand by podcasting. I think that part of content marketing will be an interesting experiment. Great. You know, let's do 10 episodes. Let's see how those 10 episodes do. And then if it accomplished what your goals were for it, then continue doing it. And if it didn't, then maybe it's okay that you shut it down at episode 7 instead of continuing to go. But I would venture to say a lot of the people that stopped after episode 7 didn't have a clear goal for their experiment, or didn't even think of it as an experiment. They just thought they'd have 100,000 listeners on day one. And when they didn't, they quit.
Yeah, I know a lot of people think that in one night they'll become like an overnight success and then have 1 million followers by the end of the month, but that's not a reality for a lot of people.
Right.
And talking a little bit about some of the consulting you do and the speaking you do, are you mostly helping out companies or individuals with their own businesses, or is it more of working with specific companies on advertising and different plans for growing their company?
It's a little bit of both. So my ideal clients are companies that do about high 6 figures or low 7 figures a year in revenue. And typically those companies have already proven that their product or service has a place in the market and has, you know, customers that really care about what they do. Because no amount of marketing is going to replace a bad product or service. And so I don't want to deal with people who have a bad product or service. I'd rather have them almost prove to me or prove to the market that they have something of quality. And so by looking at the revenue that a company is making, I can sort of start weeding people out and focus on who I want to target in my marketing. And so I look to help companies doing high 6 figures or low 7 figures in revenue. Those companies typically have a proven product or service, and they also are really only built on 1 or 2 marketing channels. So a lot of companies are kind of word of mouth or referral based up until, you know, 2 million a year in revenue. Or maybe they have an amazing outbound sales process, but they haven't done anything else. And so it's very interesting when you think about that, to add someone like me to the mix and my team, because we can go, you know, take what's worked, set up new experiments in different marketing business development channels, and potentially create scale because we find other things that are working and can help a company do more and more of that. So that's where the upside in our consulting comes from. We've helped companies quadruple sales in a month before for, you know, 6 figures in revenue gain. We've helped number one New York Times bestselling authors. We've helped Fortune 500s. We've helped VC-backed startups. So we've had some pretty awesome clients. I've purposely kept that business small. And then very recently, I've started these like VIP days, because most of my consulting contracts were, or and still are, 3 months or longer in terms of our engagement with people. And there's, you know, a certain investment level that comes with having a firm work with you for 3 months or longer. But for, you know, smaller businesses, maybe high 5 figures, low 6 figures, or solopreneurs, or people with 3 to 5 team members who have something going but want to sort of take it to the next level, We've been doing these VIP days, which are all-day strategy sessions at the place where someone's working. And those have been really cool as well, which you can learn more about at jaredkleinert.com/VIP. But that's been really interesting to kind of work with people on the strategy and then watch them go and execute upon our strategy. And so it's something that's different from our regular model, because normally we're managing most, if not all, of the execution. But this model is definitely more accessible to more entrepreneurs, and I like traveling, so it's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, I'm sure it's been fun and definitely rewarding to see some of these businesses grow after getting some help from your firm. And it's probably also been a great way to network with a lot of these people, just like the same way you'd networked with the people from your book. I'm sure you've been networking with some of the, just you've been able to network with some of the people that your firm's been working with also. That seems like a pretty recurring theme with you also.
Giving away my secrets.
Oops.
I'm going to need you to delete this recording.
To go with that, if anyone listening either wanted to reach out to you about your consulting business or just wanted to see if you had any advice or any stories, is there anywhere they can reach you on social media or any other way they can contact you?
Yeah, I'm just at Jared Kleinert on most platforms except for Instagram. It's jared.kleinert. You can email me, jared@3billionunder30.com. You can text me if you want, and I'll give you my number. It's 1-646-846-7200. You can go to jaredkleinert.com/VIP if you're interested in the VIP days. If you want to check out some free stories from the book, you can go to 3billionunder30.com. Yeah, I'm an open book.
Yeah, that's amazing contact info you gave me. I think I actually just lost a bet because I bet Mike Klum when I talked to him. He gave out his phone number and I bet him that nobody would ever give out their phone number on an interview again. But I you proved me wrong. So
I lost the bet.
I owe him 10 bucks. So
okay.
Thank you for that. But I appreciate you giving all of your info out because I know you have tons of great advice and experiences that you could help a lot of people with.
Yeah. Please don't call me, but text me.
Yeah, do not call Jared.
No, I just prefer text better. I don't really pick up the phone if I don't know who it is. But do email me with, you know, any sort of questions or let me know if this was, excuse me, I'm sneezing over here. Let me know if this was valuable to you. I'd love to get that feedback. You know, typically, I'll get one or two people that reach out after a podcast like this, and we'll have good conversations. But it's amazing how many people will listen and won't act on stuff. And maybe I just don't see them or hear that they've acted on the information. But you've invested time to listen to this for 40 something minutes. Don't walk away empty handed. Either take one nugget that Jesse or I have shared and apply it to your day to day life, or at least test it out. And if you want to tell me about it, then I'd love to hear.
Yeah, that's awesome. Because a lot of value could be taken out of some of the stuff you've been talking about. And with that, I just wanted to say thanks so much for coming on today. You gave great advice and just some lessons that a ton of aspiring entrepreneurs could use to learn how to try and build their network and start a company. And I really appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule to come on.
Yeah, anytime. Thank you.
Thanks so much. Thanks again for joining us on 20 Under 20s, where we interview the teenagers of Generation Z who are making an impact in business. To get behind-the-scenes advice from our guests and to receive the 10 best pieces of advice ever given on the show, visit 20under20s.com. That is 20under20s.com, and sign up to receive the tips. Also, please subscribe, share, rate, and review this podcast. It makes a huge difference, and I really appreciate it. Thanks, and see you next time at 20 Under 20s with Jesse Kay.